Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast brought to you by Huntworth. Huntworth gear for all types of weather, all types of terrain, all types of budgets is clothing that just works. Check them out at huntworthgear.com. So we are just coming off of our fundraiser at the Muskegon Bowman's Club to benefit the MBE Archery Foundation, which is our new nonprofit. And I just got to say, it was a great event. I want to thank everybody that came out, and a ton of our sponsors and friends of the show donated and helped make that an incredible event. So thank you so much to everybody that came out for that. It was a great time. I'm sorry if I didn't get to talk to you enough or give you guys any enough time, but it was a pretty hectic day running around getting everything, making sure everything was running smooth, but it did go well, and I just want to thank everybody that came out, supported the show, supported the Bowman's Club, and ultimately going to help the kids, you know, keep more kids and youth into archery and give them a place to learn and all of that sort of thing. So thank you so much for that. This episode with one of our sponsors. So we've talked with Jared from the Habitat Podcast and Vitalize Seed quite a bit. And Al is like the brains behind Vitalize Seed. And you're going to hear that in this podcast 100%. This is like Bill Nye, the food plot guy. Tons of information. A little information heavy right at the beginning, great information all the same about food plotting, how it works, why it works, all of that. And if you want more information on that, or you're just getting into food plotting, or another thing is if you want to go support friends of the show and, you know, some of the people that have been on the show, our friends over at the Deer Camp podcast, Hutchie Outdoors, they're doing a Habitat Field Day May 18th. You can check that out on his website. You go to Hutchie Outdoors, check them out, Facebook, Instagram. And they're doing on-site demos with the guys from Vitalize Seed, Downburst Seeders, Packer Max Cultivators, Cultipackers, all that stuff. DH3, I think the Deer Hunter podcasts are going to be up there. Habitat podcast is going to be up there. And they're doing raffles and things like that. And the proceeds are going to Outdoor Driven. So that was Andrew, who was on here, the former Marine, and their nonprofit. So another great thing in the industry, you know, kind of giving back, helping out. And yeah, so definitely check that out. Again, May 18th up in the Traverse City area. But this podcast, tons and tons of information. Congratulations to all the Patreon winners. And man, our Marco Polo group with the one shot challenge. It's all Tim's all the time. Lots of fun, lots of ribbon going on over there. Definitely if you're not taking advantage of that and you're a Patreon, get in there for the camaraderie, for the shooting, you know, motivation to shoot your bow, all that stuff. But you know, we couldn't do this show without the Patreons. You can check out patreon.com/bowhunterchroniclespodcast, or you can just click the link in our bio on Instagram and check out everything that's over there. And you get entered into win. We just did our quarterly giveaways from our partners, Huntworth, Latitude, Big Shot Targets, Spartan Forge, Lucky Buck, Kanati, and Zinger, Genesis 3D, Flambeau Outdoor Innovations, all of them. We don't partner with people. We don't work with people who don't want to give back to the community that supports us. And, you know, we can't stress that enough. So, you know, thank you to our those companies. And you can support them. You can, with Latitude, you can use code BHC for 15% off. Big Shot Targets, BCP, for 10% off. Spartan Forge, you can get 25% off using code BOWHUNTER. And, you know, we just really appreciate those and their products that we use and stand behind. So, really appreciate that. But this podcast here, and Vitalize Seed, of course, you know, they're on the podcast today. But this podcast has a lot of great information for anyone who's starting food plotting all the way to people who are experts and things that you can change and try. So you guys are going to love it. Check it out. You know, leave us a 5-star review, comment, subscribe, like, do all those things. But most importantly, enjoy the show. All right, everybody, Adam back with another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast. And today, you know, we got, for me, this is the first nice day that I've been off of work in, I don't know, 6 months, 8 months or something now. And it's starting to feel like spring. We got the camper out of storage. We're starting to get ready for the summer, Memorial Day, all that stuff. And for us as deer hunters, we think turkey season and then food plots or habitat management, all that sort of stuff. You know, we're looking at the rain, we're looking at weather, we're trying to figure out, you know, what can we do, and what better time than to have, you know, one of the food plot guys on, right? Al Tomechko, Vitalize Seed. And I don't want to like downplay Jared. We've had Jared on here a couple times. He's been up to the property and took a look around and helped us out. But when Jared talks about seed, he says, this is good. And he kind of gives you a little gloss over. And then if you follow Vitalize Seed, you see this guy on there with like a PhD in like seed and fertilizer. It seems like it's like Bill Nye, the food plot guy, of stuff. So, I said, we got to talk to this guy, and here he is today. So how are you doing today, Al?
Well, I'm doing really well, and thank you for the introduction. And yeah, a lot of guys give me a lot of good compliments, but I've gathered a lot of information from really, really smart people. And I just try to simplify it and share the science behind whether it's a food plot or a home garden or an orchard or all the way up to row crop farming. I've learned from those who are a lot smarter than I am. And I just try to, you know, reshare that information and explain it so that people can say, oh, that's why this product does or does not make sense for my particular landscape. Right. And it's been a lot of fun and I really appreciate the you having me on.
So what is your background like from a seed standpoint to, you know, cause you know, we've talked about Vitalize Seed and you can go into it about how it, you know, rebuilds the soil and it's kind of like nature's way of kind of regenerating the nutrients that you need, you know, year over year. But like, how does one get to that point? Like, where did you start out with farming and agriculture to get you here?
Yeah, well, really, you know, I'm all self-taught as far as that. I mean, I went to college and stuff like that, and I work in an industry that's heavily focused around chemistry and understanding chemical permeability. So I had a general understanding of you know, chemistry and stuff at a very high level. One of my best friends is a really brilliant chemical engineer, Greg. If you're listening, give him a shout out. So he's helped when I have, you know, discussions around polarity or something like that, right? Like really in-depth things that I'm trying to understand, whether it's for you know, Vitalize Seed or something else. But in general, I'm all self-taught, and really where it stemmed from is we had a recreational property. Now I grew up in a area where, it's very developed now, but growing up, it was pretty, small town, a lot of farming, you know, in the general area of Northern Ohio. And I always, you know, everybody had gardens, everybody like, so I always was interested in agriculture and growing a garden. My grandpap always had a big garden. I helped him there from a young age. So I always liked growing things. It always, like, since I was young, we bought a recreational property and I got very involved in QDMA forums. And it just, honestly, Adam, kind of naturally progressed into like, well, this is like, I wasn't fulfilling that desired learned amount of information, right? I'm like, there's got to be more. And I was doing things a typical way. You know, I had a tiller and a tractor and I'd till everything under. And I remember very vividly, we had been fortunate to acquire some more land. And I had done clover monocultures. I had done the brassicas. I had done beans. I had done all these different things. And I remember I was pulling soil tests. So this was probably 10, 12 years ago. And I sent them off to the co-op for, hey, here's what my soil test says. How much will this fertilizer run me? And I was doing maybe 5 acres of food plots at this time. And just for spring, it was going to cost me $2,000 in fertilizer to hit the adequate amount, right? And at that time, a switch just clicked for me. And I'm like, there has got to be another way. Like there has to be another way to do this, you know? That coupled with just the amount of contradiction that I saw within the old QDMA forums, like one guy would say, you have to do this. And the other guy would say, you have to do this. And I'm like, there has to be something else. So I knew very little about the whole world of soil science and kind of the hierarchy that there is, you know, between agronomy and soil scientists and soil microbiologists and so on. But I certainly just started diving in and reading. I mean, I have stacks of books in my desk drawers that I've read and listened to every podcast I could and things, and just kind of started putting the pieces together as how things function together, and then how we can use those biological means to help aid in our plant production. And not necessarily, I think sometimes this gets blurred with this idea of like solely being regenerative agriculture or regenerative food plotting, or what will you, which is an amazing thing. And I think everybody would like to get to that point. But I wanted to take it a step further and also have like a really strong understanding of like conventional agronomy, right? Conventional understanding of soil tests, conventional understanding of how does phosphorus move in the soil? Like, why, like, we know nitrogen is a very mobile nutrient and it goes through what's called the nitrogen cycle. And there's tons of peer-reviewed research just on that, right? But what about, you know, phosphorus and what about potassium? And well, what, how come my soil is different here than yours in Michigan? And I wanted to have an understanding of that, because without that, I felt like a lot of information that was out there that I was reading well before starting Vitalize Seed was very geared towards a specific farm or specific field or specific property. Here's what I do. It works. but there was no understanding of like, well, you're in a sandy, low CEC soil, as they would quantify it, and this guy's in a heavy clay soil, a high CEC. It's going to be very different from a management perspective. I wanted to try to bring that all together, and I started writing blogs. Honestly, I was doing a lot of stuff myself, trial and error. People told me, you can't do that. It's never going to work. You need perfect seed to soil contact. So I said, let's try it. And I'd try it. And I'd go back the next year and I'd go, well, it was a clover plot that I overseeded with rye and radish. And now look at, it all worked. You know, the radish got nipped by deer, but like I have this weed-free clover plot. Well, why? And I'd look into rye allelopathy, right? And I'd start understanding all of these different things. And again, from people who are a lot smarter than me, who've done the peer-reviewed research, but I was able to grab that information and then really understand it, or at least to the best of my competence level. And then, of course, try to share that information. And over the years, through writing blogs and getting on a podcast here and there with, you know, my buddy Jared, it got to the point where people are like, man, I'd buy that mix off of you. It just kind of naturally happened, right? And Jared had an opportunity where he has a good, you know, great platform. And that's kind of how the company itself was born. But yeah, my passion was really born in from one, wildlife management, and two, my own desire to garden and grow things.
So it seems like in there, there's a whole amalgamation of things like, you know, you're reading research from like agricultural biology on how this stuff works. You're anecdotally trying it yourself. But one thing that you didn't mention there, and I just have to wonder, like, how much of it is just like historical? Because if you know, we hear all of the bad stuff about commercial farming and how we're stripping all the nutrients from the land. And when you say that there had to be a better way, it just makes me think about 100 years ago, 200 years ago, when people were growing things, maybe not at this scale, but they didn't just go down and get a bag of triple 19 or a truckload of, you know, triple 19. And there was no, or I would imagine, very limited soil tests. So there had to be a way that they were doing it back then. Did you like look at historically how, you know, Native Americans or people did it, you know, back then, or is that part of the research?
So yes and no. So one of my favorite books that I've read was written by a gentleman named William Albrecht, Dr. William Albrecht, I should say, to put some respect on him. And he's like really well known. And the entire book is on calcium, actually. And he's one of like the fathers, which is kind of highly debated in agricultural or agronomic science, I guess I should say, just to put a broader paintbrush on it. But of understanding base saturation percentages in soil. But what he was able to do is, like, this is back in the 1920s and 30s, and he was looking at soils, and back then they weren't really using any herbicide. So it was very traditional. Now they used a lot of tillage as weed control because cultivation was really your only means of weed control. But he even then at those times was questioning microbiology. He was questioning things with, if I can put calcium right on the, you know, on the plant or near the root system, here's the type of, you know, results that I'm seeing. So that would be one example of, like, people have been observing this stuff for very long periods of time. And I'm sure there's a lot into the 1800s. I mean, the law of the minimum, which is von Liebig, I believe, was the gentleman who came up with that, which was like in the mid 18th century. Or mid 1800s. And he came up with this idea of, like, you can't hit your maximum yield unless you fill the bottom hole in the bucket, which comes into like micronutrients and things like that. But really what was interesting about that is there was a lot of referencing of like manure usage, right? Or night soil, because they took a lot of stuff from sewage, basically from the cities, and they were putting it out. What changes when you get into the conventional agriculture, which I think that gets a little bit misconstrued, because I have been very fortunate and very blessed to work with some really big farmers and learn certainly from some. And I think that there's this like idea sometimes, like, that's perpetuated, that like these farmers like don't know what they're doing. Like, they don't know what they're doing. They're just in there to, you know, make a buck. And it's like, well, first, that's not true. Like, they're not spreading fertilizer because they want to spend the money. You know, like, I think that gets for whatever reason, there's this, well, like most things in this country, right? You always have two sides, and one side screaming, my way is the best. But instead of coming together and working together, where the truth's somewhere in the middle, they just fight against each other. You know, it's like tillage versus non-till. And we could have a 8-hour podcast just on some of the reasons as to why sometimes that does make sense or doesn't make sense. But the biggest thing is if you're using, in conventional systems, you're in some cases they have access to manure, but they, in other cases they don't, right? So in the old days, you probably used a lot more tillage, but then you had farm animals like in the yard, right? You're going back into the early 20s, a lot smaller farms. It was easy to clean out a chicken house and put it out onto a field, you know? And even if you were using tillage, okay, we know tillage is, there's no arguing from a chemical side point. Like it is going to cause, you're pumping oxygen in there, right? It is going to cause microbes to be stimulated. It's going to consume carbon. And eventually, if you don't have enough carbon stores, it's going to consume organic matter. Like that's not, you can't argue it. It absolutely will happen. It obviously can cause erosion issues. There are without a doubt negatives to tillage. The other thing about tillage is it works. Like that's the other argument like that I always bring up to people is like, don't people go, oh, no till versus till. I tried no till. It was harder. Yeah. Yeah. It's probably going to be because you're not getting this burst of oxygen and basically, which is fertility, right? Because it's breaking down organic matter and carbon, which has been neutralized or solubilized fertility for those plants. But when you go into the conventional systems, we've grown them so large, you know, and we're using more chemistry and herbicides and things like that, that you're probably not getting that natural source of manure, depending on where you're at in the country. I work with an agronomist in Pennsylvania. They use a ton of manure. So because of that, they almost never have to put synthetic phosphorus. So all of that to say is, hopefully I didn't get too long-winded there. I apologize if I did. But all of that to say, I think it's very site-specific in how the fertility is managed. But I think the biggest thing is that we just need to understand that many, many years people did things in different ways. And scale plays a very big role into how and what you're doing. You know, it's easier to do something on a half acre than it is to do it on an acre, than it is to do it on 10. So keep that in mind as well. If you're casting judgment or saying, well, here's what I did on my place, it works. Well, right. You can till and put triple 13 and you can pack it down, but you did an acre food plot. But if you're giving advice to the guy who's doing 50 acres in food plots, that's a much bigger cost, much bigger variability in the terrain he's probably doing it in, et cetera.
Are you overwhelmed by the hundreds of food plot mixes out there? Well, you are not alone. And Vitalize Seed has developed a program that takes the guesswork out of food plotting. Vitalize makes it simple with their two core mixes, Nitro Boost and Carbon Load. Nitro Boost is their spring-summer food plot mix, and Carbon Load is for planting in the fall, each having a diverse mix of over a dozen seed types that are highly attractive to whitetail. Food plotting made simple. Each mix provides necessary nutrients to the soil, making for better plots each season. This also saves you money by needing less Roundup and fertilizer every year. The 1-2 system simplifies your food plots just how nature intended. And for the more advanced habitat managers, Vitalize also offers a variety of natural amendments with products like their seed feed that offer seeds immediately available minerals ready as soon as they germinate. Make biology work for you. Order now at vitalizeseed.com.
So for all that, when you got to have these conversations multiple times a day, a week about, they're the Al back in the day where they say, well, I don't have the equipment and I don't have $2,000 for fertilizer. Where do I start or how do I begin? And then, or the guy that's tried it and failed and is discouraged, like, yeah, how do you enter into those conversations?
It's a great question. I mean, typically what I tell people is everything I like to say starts with a soil test, but I mean, a soil test lab or soil test analysis is only as good as the data in which it receives, right? Or the sample in which it receives. So number one, I probably take it too far, but again, I learned from those who are smarter than me, who are doing this to pay for a lot of mortgages and a lot of farm ground or whatnot. So if they're using GPS coordinates to pull their soil tests every year, well, by gosh, I'm going to do the same thing. Like I use Onyx Maps. I mark every field with GPS coordinates. I mark a soil probe that I take 6 inch down. Like, I want to keep those as consistent as possible. So I go to a GPS coordinate, I take 3 or 4 samples out of that GPS coordinate. And then, you know, on an acre, I might have 4 or 5 of those GPS coordinates. But every year, I'm hoping that probe's going down into the same hole or two from the prior year, the same depth, the same time of year, because again, soils are alive. There's biology happening. So things should be changing. You know, they shouldn't be stagnant throughout the whole year as you have more heat units or whatnot. So number one, I tell guys, if you're not getting an accurate sample or not sampling, and you're just like, well, so-and-so told me, put on gypsum because it sweetens the soil, right? Like, I've heard people say that gypsum, it sweetens the soil. Gypsum's a great product. Benjamin Franklin talked about using gypsum on his alfalfa and he noticed that the cattle would eat it more frequently, and he would call it sweeten the alfalfa. Thing is, Virginia, Southern Pennsylvania, higher CEC soil, probably really benefited from more calcium. Right. Just generally, you can kind of put that together. But somebody in a sandy soil in Michigan who's just pouring gypsum to it without having a soil test to understand structure, you're going to end up chasing your tail because you're going to actually add porosity to that soil profile, which in a sandier soil, believe it or not, we want that soil to be a little tighter. We want to try to hold that water. We don't want water to run through there like, you know, going through a screen door. Right. So it's understanding that structure. So number one mistake I see people is either not sampling or not taking a quality sample. The other thing I see a lot of mistakes, and we work with Ward Labs, just letting you know, there's a ton of good labs out there. But if you're going to get a sample, get a full sample. Ward Labs on our website, it's $23 for a sample. You get organic matter, you get pH, you get base saturations, you get micronutrients, you get the full picture. A lot of times, if you pay $10, $12, $14, you don't, like, somebody will send me and I'm like, I can give you general information, but we don't even have the full picture. So then you either have to go take another test or now you're guessing on types of lime and stuff. So the other thing I would say is get a quality test. Logan Labs, Ward Labs, Midwest Labs. I think there's one on Michigan, Great Lakes Labs. They all have very similar testing procedures and do a very nice job if you pick their full picture one. I'm very comfortable with Ward. I've used them for many, many years and have been happy with it. A couple other things I see as mistakes. Not enough sunlight. You know, you have to understand size of the plot. What are you trying to get accomplished in that? So sometimes not enough sunlight. More than not an exclusion fence, not understanding browse pressure. And this is just broad spectrum, whether you're using Vitalized Seed or something else. This is just broad, generalized mistakes I see things that are overlooked, not understanding an exclusion or not having exclusion fence and seeing, hey, was it a soil fertility thing? Was it a seed predation thing? Or was it a browse problem? So I think that's another big thing. A lot of times, once people put that exclusion fence up, they see, I either need to plant more food, shoot more deer, or both, right? Like, that's a big moving target. And maybe planting more food is in TSI. I'm not necessarily saying it has to be in a food traditional food plot, but do something to increase that available food on the landscape. So those would probably be the most frequently overlooked issues, would be those two or three items that I touched on there.
And I guess in the climate of the hunting industry, the seed industry, the food plot industry, what do you think are the biggest misunderstandings about seed products that are out there? Because I would imagine, I mean, I guess I always say that broadheads are the worst industry to get into or niche, because it's either the greatest thing or the bad thing, the worst thing. But I could see food plot seed being another one, because if you don't have all of the good pre-work done, or you don't have good soil, or you don't have any of that stuff that you just outlined, you could have the best seed in the world and it would still fail or not meet your expectations. And, you know, you've put in all this work and it could really sour you on it. So with all the products and the way that the food plotting industry and habitat management, I guess, as a whole industry is, what do you think are some of the biggest misunderstandings outside of the prep work?
So in the seed industry, I think the biggest misunderstanding is, you know, what works for me as the planter, right? Or as the grower, you know? And I think that that's common really in not just the seed industry, but even in farming. Like we work, one of the things that, you know, when Jared and I talked about forming a business, I'm like, I don't want to call it, you know, Big Buck Seed. Not that there's anything wrong if there is a Big Buck Seed company out there, sorry. But I didn't want to do that intentionally for the fact that
you want to succeed, you want to fish, you want to be one of the greatest.
Tune in to West Marine's Life on the Water, presented by Costa Custom Boats, every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
You'd think, with four of us spread out on a tiny island, that the task of tagging a whitetail would not be a big thing. But, as I've learned, no matter where I've been, whitetails can be damn tricky.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
I wanted to work with growers. I wanted to work with the home gardener. I wanted to work with farmers. And we've been very fortunate to have that. But it still pretty much translates all industries. Like I see where people, there's so much information out there. And there's so much. Well, if I want to break up compaction, I need to plant daikon radish, let's just say, right? And there's this like thought that that's the thing. Well, yes and no. You really would be beneficial to have a much more diverse mix because you have a varying root structures, right? And let's say that you have a nematode problem following your Delilah plantings for whatever reason. Well, maybe that daikon radish is going to get ate up by the nematodes and you're not going to have that issue if you have, you know, rye grain and winter wheat and everything else. So you have this diversity, which is going to help in stress tolerance, things like that. So that's number one, I think, is just understanding. And one of the things we wanted to do is bring simplicity. Here is these two diverse mixes that are made to work off of each other. And I can talk about how and why those work later. But that would be number one. I think the other big issue, and I think this is just natural for people to do, but it's just overdoing it. Right? The need to over apply, be it a fertilizer, be it a seed. You know, we were talking about farmers or the farmers kind of get a bad rap, but like one of the things I often look at, I drive through a development, you know, a housing development. And I look at, you know, when they're applying fertilizer to these yards and I'm thinking, who's talking about that amount of nitrate leaching out? Because nobody's even measured. I mean, they got a truck with a hose hooked up and they're just spraying it on. And that might only need 25 units of N to carry it for the next 2 months. And they're out there every other week just applying the nitrogen like it stole something. You know, so it's like, well, who's monitoring that? So I think just in general, we tend to think more is better, more is better, more is better. And certainly we know in soil chemistry and biology, like that just simply isn't the case. I mean, you don't want to plant, one thing I've been pretty vocal about is you don't want to plant rye grain at 200 pounds to the acre or 300 pounds or whatever the rates that are set out there in a large majority of settings. It's going to choke out everything else. I mean, unless you just want a monoculture of rye, but again, to put that into perspective, most farmers who are planting rye as a cover crop, they'll plant like 30 to maybe 75 pounds of the acre of rye to capture some of that nitrate leaving. Now, larger fields, you know, so I can understand guys saying, well, I want to plant a little bit higher with the deer density, but those are things where it's like more is better, more is better. I've seen people say I put down outrageous amounts. And I'm like, one, I think you're just getting to a point of diminishing returns, right? You're starting to lose money. You're not going to have all that seed germinate. And two, I just think in the long term, you're not really benefiting much of anything. I'd rather grow a little bit less high quality crops than too many crops squeezed together that's not really benefiting anything, right? So I would say that's probably the most common. I think one other thing I would say just in general with the seed industry, and again, this translates into agriculture as well, is, well, I've always done it this way, so there's no other way I should look at doing it, you know? And I think that causes, like in anything, right? If you know, that's the way we've always done it is a very dangerous saying. And I think that we have to realize that even the smartest soil scientists in the world are saying, we don't understand everything that's happening. All of the fungal communication, like it is a very, very, very complex system. But what we do know is that certain species work well together and there's synergies, and you can certainly see the observationally, and you can measure beneficial things that are happening within the soil profile. And then, of course, from a deer's perspective, obviously we're talking to deer hunters here, at least I would assume, right? So from a deer hunter's perspective, we can measure these things from observational analysis from the stand, but also getting those exclusion fences up, right? And measuring, hey, how much are my deer removing and how much are they liking this or not? And you can even get species specific if you're doing a diverse mix like ours. And then, of course, you know, camera analysis on those particular food plots can be very beneficial.
So one of the things you talked about there was the applying too much. And I think you said it there right at the end. It's like, you know, we're dealing with deer hunters there. And at least in my case, I'm a deer hunter with very little agricultural background. And, you know, you tried to do food plots or whatever, and you get this big bag of seed and you're like, okay, well, this is going to be like for a half acre, quarter acre, blah, blah, blah. And you go out there and you're hand seeding it, or you're, you know, using your whatever. And now you've got a half a bucket of seed left and you're like, well, what am I going to do with it? I don't have any other food plots, so I'm just going to chuck it out here or whatever. How do you as a, I mean, I guess on some level, you know, you sell more seed because people just waste it, but, you know, but then they could be unhappy because they're not getting the yield they want because they're overseeding. Like, how do you educate people on that? Or how, I mean, you're right. It's in our nature to do too much. So how is that communicated?
So it's interesting. So the smallest unit we sell right now is a, half acre bag. And on occasion, you know, we'll get the guy who says, I just, you know, I have one food plot and it's a quarter acre and that's it. And although it might be better to say, yeah, put it all on there, you know, I don't ever like to do that. So what I tell guys is, listen, because you're broadcasting, you're using a chain drag to drag it in, or, you know, whatever tools you have, I'll try to work them through that. And then I'll say, bump up the seeding rate by, you know, because you're broadcasting, right? So you're always going to reduce some success rate, like versus like a no-till drill or something. So bump it up 10%, 20%, you know, and then save that seed. And what I tell them is, if you have a chance to go back in a month, two weeks, a month and a half, and you see some thin spots, then just go over and touch up those thin spots by hand. You know, if you can time it with the rain, and everybody says, you know, are you 3 hours away? Are you 8 hours away? Are you an hour away? Or it's your backyard? You know, everybody's different, but that's what I would rather see. And then I tell guys, if it looks great and it's all filled in, then just store that seed in a cool, dry place. Next year, you buy a half acre, you know, you lose a little or use that up first and then top it over and then save that one and just kind of keep that rotation going. Right. And the thing is like some people would say, well, that's not that true because, you know, farmers are harvesting that for a yield. They don't want variability because when they harvest, bring a combine through to cut beans, they need all the beans ready to be cut. You know, they can't have, oh, turn around, we went 100 yards, this little section, you know, that doesn't work. But for wildlife or for a cover crop in general, if you're just planting after, it doesn't matter if you, you know, fly it on, till it in, whatever, just to get that cover crop established if it's staged or staggered in growth perspective. So to me, that's what I recommend to people. And most people who have tried that have been really, really happy with the results.
And then you guys are doing the two-stage method, one seed and the other. And we can go into how all of that works and how they work together. But for timing, for your average Midwest guy, so, you know, Michigan would be on the north end, but you're going from, you know, Missouri to Pennsylvania, right? What is the best times and the best? I feel like personally, there's a best time for growth and a best time for hunting, if that makes sense. Like you can plant it and get something really good that the deer could just ravage and it's not set up for you to hunt over it, right?
So in our spring mix or spring summer mix, it's a singular mix, Nitro Boost, you know, and that really is getting for the deer hunters. That's getting your soil prepped. That's your cover crop for your cash crop. Let's put it like that way for deer hunters, right? You're getting your soil prepped. You're feeding the deer all summer. You're getting them accustomed to coming there. But most importantly, you're going to fix a ton of nitrogen. You're going to help break down the thatch that's already there. So when you plant our fall carbon load, you're going to be in a situation where you can reduce inputs because it's going to be getting those inputs from that cycling that happened from the Nitro Boost. So for that particular product, I like to aim around middle of May, generalized across the Midwest. That works really well. And then you can plant your fall mix. I like to plant right around the first 15 days of August. I think that's the sweet spot. I think if you go a little bit too early, you're going to get, I just think you're a little bit higher risk for drought. And I think that you're just in a better situation if you can get right around August. I think 2 years ago, I was August 13th and last year was August 15th and has been tremendously successful. I have had guys in like northern West Virginia, you know, again, kind of getting on that north end of the south or south end of the north. I'm not sure, but they'll be planting into, you know, the first week of September. So West Virginia, Kentucky, they might get into that like first week of September or so. But I think that's kind of that good mix. Or most of Michigan, you know, northern Michigan, you might be in the first week of August. But I think that's good. And it's been really successful for us in maximizing the production of both having a great grain crop, but also still getting enough time for those brassicas to put down, you know, good roots and then also really create a good bulb for the varieties that we use that are tuber or bulb production brassicas.
So something we haven't talked about in, I mean, I guess you kind of mentioned it for like the thin spots and the overseeding and stuff like that. But let's say that you do that planting, you know, mid-May and you don't get the water, you don't get rain, you're in a drought or something like that. And you're kind of going into the season or even as you're planting in August and you're coming up middle of September and you're just not seeing the results. You've got your fencing up so you can see that you're just not getting the growth that you were expecting or you were hoping for. Is there a way to quote unquote salvage it or fix it for the upcoming season? And what would be some signs that things weren't going well and ways to remedy that?
It's a good question. I mean, I think really it's the bigger question there is how do you mitigate that risk going forward, right? And that's where you get into the evolution and the reason people are such large proponents for no-till, right? Keeping the soil covered, keeping a constant root growing, et cetera. Because why? Well, because the biggest threat in most food plotters' world is going to be drought. Right. Most guys that don't have irrigation, they're not running a pivot. They're, you know, so the biggest risk for them as far as success goes, maybe not monetary, but just the success of the field is going to be a drought situation. And how do you retain moisture? Well, no-till, keeping the soil covered, those type of things are going to increase your rate of success, but also taking soil tests and making sure that we have those base saturations accurate so that we're not. There's a famous saying, and I forget who said it, Gabe Brown or somebody like that. They said, it's not about how much rain I get. It's how much rain I keep, right, on my field. And it's pretty profound, right, in the sense of how much water is infiltrating into that soil profile. So I think that if you're looking to just salvage it, it could be difficult, right? I mean, you can always replant. I mean, you can always replant ahead of a rain, and you're and that likely would be better than just leaving it fallow. Let's pretend it was just total drought destruction. But in some cases, it's going to be okay. Let's get a good fall crop established. You know, we got a month left before the fall is coming in, and we got to figure out what can we do next year to make this work. And I'll tell you, Adam, I'm very fortunate, you know, after many, many years of owning the farm and managing it, we have a big farm that we manage for whitetails and for timber and soil, right? And, or relatively big, it's big to me, but you know, we're no tilling in. And last year we got 2 inches of rain after we no till. I mean, it was like as picture perfect. And then it didn't rain for like 62 days in a high deer density area. So it was like everything germinated, got 3 inches out of the ground, and then you had no rain for 60 days. Now luckily we ended up catching some rains and things caught up, and a lot of the nitrogen, as you say on my Instagram, you saw like a lot of the plots looked really, really good by come plant and fall time was getting ready to go. But I did say to my buddy, you know, we're in Eastern Ohio. It's pretty rough terrain. You're in the foothills of Appalachia. Like, had I tilled all of that ground last year, that would have been a disaster. Like, I know undoubtedly I never would have been able to have the plots that we ended up having, because they're just simply, they're, one, we got so much hard rain right after planting. A lot of it would have been high risk for erosion due to our terrain. And then number two, with that drought, it would have just baked like a cake. I mean, there's just no way. So again, if you are some guy who's going to do tillage or likes tillage, a big thing I like to do is say, hey man, don't throw the tiller away. Don't, you know, don't be upset with me, but let's talk about, can we do conventional tillage, or excuse me, conservation tillage versus conventional, which means can we leave some soil covered, you know, after we run a tiller through there, instead of tilling everything into dust, what if we till it a half inch just to kind of terminate that previous crop seed and then leave some grain from the previous crop laying on top, right? Or rye grain or whatnot. So those are some things that I would say in that situation. It's going to be hard. I mean, you're probably going to have to say, okay, what did I do wrong? And how do I learn for next year? Which stinks, because everybody wants that instant gratification, but you know, farming or gardening or growing food plots for wildlife, farming for wildlife, it's all the same. And a lot of times it's, what do I have to do next year so I can reduce that risk?
Sure. But I think that's the hardest thing, right? Is like, once, I don't know. And I know I've said this before, and I don't know if it was with Jared or with whom, but part of you in, I guess, of the fear of moving towards this food plotting journey or whatever, saying, okay, we're going to do this, is it's like, I would almost rather do nothing and fail than put in a whole lot of work and a whole lot of money and fail, you know? That's where it becomes like, is it worth it? How many year, you know, if you feel like you did everything right and you're trying and, you know, the moons don't align and the weather isn't there or whatever. I mean, that's the hard part. So that's what I'm trying to figure out, the answer for the guy that's just starting out and having a rough go, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I certainly think you can have that occur, right? And I think we could take that philosophy with anything in our life. Like, well, why put it into a 401k? Because, you know, what if 1929 happens again? You know, like, you get into this, like, well, because the last 80 years after that have been, you know, pretty good overall for the stock market for long term, right? So I think we have to realize that, you know, but risk mitigation is important. And that's like one of the benefits of having a highly diverse mix. So a good example of this would be you plant, I see this all the time, guys, but I planted a monoculture of brassicas. My deer don't eat brassicas. Now I have this field. I don't know what the heck to do with it. It came up beautiful, but I have a field of brassicas that deer don't eat. Oddly enough, we don't hear that in highly diverse mixes. I have some theories as to why, but nonetheless, we don't really hear that. Then you also have the situation where guys go, man, I planted a field of brassicas, monoculture brassicas, and the deer hammered it, and then I had nothing left, and I came back in the spring, and now I don't know what to do because it's just filled with weeds. Because, well, why? Well, basically, the deer rototilled it for you. It sat fallowed for all winter. It got rained on, snowed on. It's got compaction issues happening. And now it's just a muddy mess, and it's going to be full of yellow rocket and all of these nasty invasive weeds. So, well, how do you mitigate that? Using highly diverse mixes where you're going to have grains and clovers and all these things that are working to compete these weeds coming back out of the spring. One of my favorite times of years right now, because my phone doesn't stop ringing with texts and pictures and stuff, people saying, man, I love this carbon though. Look how there's not a weed in here, because it's smothering those weeds, right? So summertime plots are always going to be more difficult than fall time, always. So I tell the guy, if he's just starting out, or girl, you know, guy or gal that calls in, they're like, I'm just starting out, I have a small food plot, you know, what do you recommend? Well, in some cases I say, I'd start with the carbon. It's our fall mix. I'd start then. And in some cases, let's say it's a real, they have a less than a half acre plot, quarter acre plot, high deer density. They're few hours away to where they can't really maintain it. I'm like, I plant the carbon load And I just let those clovers go to work all summer for you. Let it come back that next spring and summer. Let it, it's going to head out. Turkeys are going to come there and nip it. And then next fall, I terminate it and plant it again. So now you've reduced your cost. You're still doing great things for the soil. Is it as efficient as the nitrogen? No, I truly believe that. You're not going to get the sorghum in Sudan that's going to help to grab nitrate that's way down in. You're not going to break up that deep soil compaction. You're not going to have drought tolerant species like we added Sudan grass this year. Well, deer don't eat Sudan grass. You're right. I don't want deer to eat every single thing that's fixing or assimilating nutrients in my soil for my cash crop, right, or my fall crop. So we added that in there. It's a very drought tolerant species. So that alone, you know, you're going to always have something feeding the soil, feeding, you know, covering the soil, acting as structure for some of these other plants to increase browsability. You know, so there's a lot of thought that goes into that to help to mitigate that risk for the guys and gals that are just starting out. Because quite frankly, it can be overwhelming. You know, you get into reading on just clover maintenance. It's like, holy cow, I need this chemical and that chemical and 2 ounces per this, but the sprayer needs to be calibrated. And guys like, I got a hand pump. Like, what do you mean calibrated? You know, and it gets really, so for me, when you figure in all those other factors, you can use really diverse mixes. Kill everything off, be it a light tillage or an herbicide or a mowing or something like that, seed and pray for rain. I mean, and that's really all you have to do. You get a little bit of moisture and something's going to grow. And Adam, as fortunate as I am, I still have little plots that I plant with our nitro boost and carbon load with nothing more than a backpack sprayer and a bag spreader. And they look equally as good as some of the ones that I've no-till drilled.
So let's talk about that, because my next question was going to be, so what is the difference? You know, I mean, obviously you're talking about the normal, tilling, you know, rip up the soil, put it in, compact it, all that stuff. But what is the difference between, or I guess, what is the process for that you use for no-till? Because I think that there's maybe some sort of a disconnect or miscommunication between no-till and throw and grow, right?
So the process that I use is variable. So I change it depending on the field. So that's what I try to tell people a lot is, I think a lot of times we have to understand what is our goal as a food plotter. Like, what is our perception of beauty of the food plot, or, you know, whatnot? It can't just be, oh, I want to shoot a big buck over it, like, you know, the Drury Brothers do, because that happens. It certainly happens from time to time. But how are we going to get there, right? So, like, what I tell guys is, if I get to a field and I cut the tractor off, or if it's a field that I'm doing just bag spreader, I get out and I look at the field. And is it 80%, 90% the crop that I want in there, right, from the previous planting? So let's say I'm planting nitro boost, is I get in and it's, oh, it's all carbon load. It's grains, it's clovers. Well, then if I'm drilling with the, I might just drill through it and drive off, do nothing else, right? Now this year I do have a roller crimper. So I'm going to be doing some experimenting with roller crimp and even doing some different stage roller crimping, like trying to crimp, come back 2-3 weeks later. Then I realized most people aren't doing that. I don't have an expensive roller crimper. I bought one from a guy who welds them in his garage for like a few $100. I'm not spending $8,000 or whatever it is for roller crimpers. But the point being, so like you do that, I've used a harrow drag before just to flatten everything out. Now some stuff stands back up, but it's not like 90% stands back up, right? Maybe, I don't know, 60%. And then I've had, you know, a great mix of diversity coming up. So that's one way that I do no-till. Another way is obviously using herbicide. I'm not somebody who's like anti-herbicide. I want to reduce my need for synthetic items, right? I don't want to have to use herbicide 3 times, 4 times a year. You know, we used to plant monoculture soybeans and it's like, you know, we sprayed everything. Then we tilled, then we planted soybeans and we came back in 2 weeks and we sprayed again. And we came back at like 6 or 8 weeks and we sprayed again, you know, just to grow soybean food plot. It's like, it's crazy. You know, on one field, we went over it 10 times. So for me, I want to reduce that, but if I have to use a glyphosate or something like that, I'll certainly use it. And that works very well. You spray it, you seed into that thatch that's either dead standing or you want to roll it over and mow it off. That works very well. And then, you know, obviously the last one is mowing, whether you want to talk flail mowing or even bush hogging. The only argument I've ever heard against bush hogging, is, well, you can get like windrow to occur and that can cause issues with seed not being able to germinate it. I didn't germinate through that. I've never had that phenomenon happen. Just like if you're mowing your yard and you saw an area where there was a big pile of grass, like what does everybody do? They just hit it again. You know, they just run it over again, spread it out so it's not as thick. And I've done the same thing and, you know, had really, really beautiful food plots doing that. So those are, I hope that answered your question, but those are kind of the different methods that I use. There's physical, there's chemical, and or just seed and drive away.
Okay. So when you're doing those small ones with just a backpack sprayer and a whatever, the broadcast spreader, what are you doing? Like let's say you were going into a brand new kill plot in the woods, right? So you got some overhead cover, but you got an open spot. What are you doing and how are you getting that ready, prepping it to plant?
I'll be honest with you. I'm not going to do a whole, I mean, other than I will soil test. I'm going to soil test it. And then,
pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 PM Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. Four in the morning.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. Birds up in the sky.
Oh, that's awesome.
Don't miss Thursdays with Saltwater Experience, brought to you by Golden Boat Lifts, every Thursday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Most likely, let's just say I can't get any equipment in there. None. I'm going to spray it with, let's just say it's goldenrod. So, because I, of course, you could get into the nuances like, oh, well, are you going to leave the brush in there? Like, let's say it's a open field, but it's just like goldenrod. So something that's not going to cause major issues as far as getting around. I'm going to spray it with 41% glyphosate. You know, I'm going to be careful, going to wear my PPE, you know, I'm going to spray that down and I'm going to let it dry. And I'm going to seed into it. And I'm going to probably increase my seed rate, let's say, by 15%, you know, maybe. So a couple, few pounds, right, on that area. It's a half acre. Instead of 20, 25 pounds, maybe I do 30, something like that. And I'm going to pray for rain. I mean, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to make sure that I get really good seed coverage. You know, I always tell people I like to start at one end and kind of zigzag back and forth. And don't pour all of your seed in your spreader at one time. Pour half in and try to get a single coverage on that area that you're spreading, whether it's a half acre, a whole acre, 8 acres, it doesn't matter. Spread half the seed that you got to get coverage completely, and then go to the other end of the field that you started on and do the same thing, but start on a different starting point. That way you have to kind of you're not mapped in your mind, right? You're going to read back and forth to get that good coverage. That's all I'm doing on that. Would it help if you went in there and you rolled everything over or you cut it down with a weed whip or something like that? Sure. I mean, you can, but I mean, I've grown 3 and 4 acre food plots with nothing more than a whirlybird spreader on a tractor and a 25 gallon sprayer on a four wheeler, where I went in and sprayed stuff that was 6 foot tall and drove the tractor through and just whirlybirded it through and backed out and absolutely had. So that would be my tip on that. Keep it simple.
I think that helps most guys, because I think, you know, most guys that have an area to do a big food plot with tractors and things already kind of have an idea of what they want to do, where most people who are just getting into it, I would think, will start small and say, okay, well, I just want to do this and try it and see, or it's specifically so like a kill type plot where they only have so much area, but they have this one area that they think that they can plant. Right.
Yeah. Well, and that's, so I'll give you another quick example is I have, again, it's everybody's goals. So I have this really awesome customer, shot at Bruiser of a Buck, Southeastern Ohio, Mr. Tim, if you're listening, he's just an awesome guy, but he and his wife don't want to use herbicide. They live on their farm, you know, and he came to me and he's like, you know, we're talking and I'm like, okay, well, You don't want to use herbicide. What do you have? You know, and he's, I got a disc and I got the, you know, so we came up with a plan for him where it's like, okay, you're going to disc, but you're not going to just pulverize the soil, right? You're going to just do like a light disking. Now he lives on his property, so that's a big benefit, right? But we went through the stages of what's going to work for him. And he had, I mean, I'm sure I shared a bunch of pictures. He had amazing food plots. He did a real light disking. You know, kept this, try to keep the soil covered. He seeded right before the rain. He was like pulling a tractor, and I believe, or his four wheel, I forget which one he has his seeder hooked up to, you know, as it's raining, right? And it came out beautifully. So I try to tell people, you can be successful with whatever you have. You just got to come up with a plan. Another big one, a lot of guys have a harrow drag. They're like, I don't know, a couple $100. They have the spike side or the flat side. If you can get a little four wheeler with one of those in, and if you want to, you know, spray something down, you know, spray glyphosate and go a couple donuts with the spike side, you're not going to be moldboard plowing the soil here. You know, you're just kind of scratching the surface. Seed it, put it on the flat side and do the same thing. You're going to have phenomenal seed to soil contact. Now we just need to pray for rain. So again, I think there's a lot of ways to do it. And, we don't have to make it overly complicated. I think sometimes there's like 385 steps, like, you know, till it and fit the ground and seed it and then fit it again. It's like these seeds, we got to give them more credit. I got soybeans growing in my driveway from where I spilled seed before. You know, like it's not, these seeds are little balls of energy and they want to grow. We just have to try to give them the best chance.
And so with that, you guys have had, talking to Jared, some additions to your lineup of kind of like those little extras. So for guys that are a little bit further along in the journey, or they want to give their seeds a little bit more of a chance or whatever, what are some of the other like micronutrient programs? And I don't know if there was like, there was other like spore stuff in there and all, there was all sorts of stuff that was way over my head. But that you guys offer to kind of help the stuff grow, right?
Yeah. So right off the bat, we offer it with every purchase of our seed. It's inside the bag this year. It's called our Seed Armor Plus. That is a, so I was very frustrated because again, you go to buy inoculant, right? Which inoculant is just a bacteria that you're going to put on a seed. It's going to guarantee, it's like an insurance policy. You guarantee that that bean has the right strand of bacteria to fix nitrogen, atmospheric nitrogen, right? It's a synergistic relationship with a certain type of bacteria in the soil. So what I was really frustrated was like most food plotters, well, if you're trying to do a diverse mix, you'd have to buy 5 pounds of bean inoculant and 10 pounds of pea. And you're like, well, what in the world? I don't need 30 pounds of different inoculants. Like I just need a little bit to cover 50 pounds of seed or 25 pounds of seed. So finally, I was able to get a blended inoculant product that covers all of the legumes in our mix. And then we add our own spin there with a proprietary Humix blend, which Humix is pretty popular right now, but really all it is going to help with is seed germination, water retention. It has microbial stimulation. It is all a natural product. Think of humus is like the basis of organic matter, right? So it helps with all of those things. And that's in our product and just gives the seeds off to a good start. It's no magic dust. It's again, it's just like an insurance policy to help out. I did have a couple guys last year say, I wanted to try half and half. And every one of them called me and goes, son of a gun, the area I used the half on versus not was way ahead of the other side. I'm like, well, yeah, probably just germinated, you know, a little bit faster and got off to a good start. So that's the one product that we offer. It's inside the bag, like Cracker Jack box. We did add Vitalized Micros, again, humic base. We went through, we don't have iron in that product, but all your other core micros. The reason we left iron out is after looking at thousands of soil samples over the last several years, most soils have enough iron in them. I don't almost never do I see an iron deficiency. So why would you want to put something down there more? Because remember, everything is going to have synergistic or antagonistic relationships. So as certain things go up, other things go down. So with that being said, we wanted to add Vitalized Micros that covers all of your micronutrients other than iron, even boron. It also has some calcium and sulfur in there. We do see a lot of sulfur deficiencies. Makes sense because the EPA has made it a lot of regulations along contamination into our air, right, with coal and things like that. So we don't have, we used to get a lot of sulfur actually back in like the 80s and 90s, I believe, with from the rain. But you don't get those levels anymore because of the EPA regulations. So now you're starting to see a lot. They talk about it a lot in the ag industry about having sulfur deficiencies and how they're having to make that up now through different ways. So we added a calcium and a sulfur product there. And again, a humic base. So it can be a little bit dusty. That's a product you add maybe every other year. And it's hopefully something that you're not going to be adding every year. We recommend 25 pounds the acre. You do broadcast it on. I put it on with lime. And it's just something that we're looking to hit some numbers on a soil test, not something that we're looking to, you know, necessarily drive yield. It's more getting that, making sure the bank, if you will, is full in the soil. The other products that we offer is a seed feed product. This was probably my favorite product that we have. There's a lot of science, and I can get all nerded out and pretty passionate about, like phosphorus, for example, is very immobile in the soil. And most guys who are doing no-till systems, you're not going to get phosphorus if you're broadcasting it on top. Now, some guys will say, well, it moves a quarter inch a year. A quarter inch a year takes a long time to get into a root zone, right? Like a very long time. However, there's a lot of really smart biologists, Dr. Christine Jones, for example, who say most soils have tons, I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of phosphorus. It's just a matter of getting them bioavailable or solubilized so that the plant can take them up. What seed feed is it's a natural product of NPK, calcium, we have humics in there, all the things that a young seedling or young seed would want. But instead of trying to broadcast this on there and hope to find the roots, right? We're going to put it right on the seed. So if it's in a broadcast spreader or a whirlybird spreader, you put it on the seed just like that inoculant. You mix it up. It sticks to the seed. It adheres to the seed. If it's in a drill, it's going to fall down. It's going to be right on that seed. So now when that seed starts off, that little bubble of nutrients, right, is right there to give it off to a good start so that it can get off to a can get off to a good growth. I also use it. I've done some videos, even like on my tomato stars and things like that. Like I got a few hundred tomato plants growing in my house right now. And I use it there. Again, just dust the seeds with them, put it in the soil, cover it. So they have that little bit of nutrients to get established. And then from there, we want biology to take it. The other product that you probably hit on was the mycorrhizal fungi product. Again, one of the keys to solubilizing phosphorus and other nutrients, but phosphorus in particular, I'll just talk about one because, again, we don't want this to go for 4 days. But phosphorus in particular is one that's really a complex nutrient, right? I mean, we know we have a lot of it, but it's difficult to get there. You know, farmers will put it right in the furrow, right under 2x2 on corn so that they make sure it's right in where that root zone is going to be. Well, what we also know is that in no-till systems in particularly, where we can, over time, there's a testing called PFLA testing, but which is phospholipid fatty acid. Phospholipid fatty acids. But what we can do with that, it's a fancy way of saying we can tell bacterial to fungal ratios in our soils. And what they learned over time, Adam, is say year one is high bacteria and year five is pretty high bacteria. Year 10 in a no-till system, you're going to start to lend, if it's balanced right and stuff, or even in nature, it's going to start to become forced. What ends up dominating it in my rambling is fungal networks. What happens in fungal networks is how do you grow a really big oak tree? You need a lot of phosphorus. Well, how are those oak trees getting that phosphorus? They're certainly not getting fertilized. So how are they getting it? And a lot of that is through mycorrhizal connections in the soil. The roots are paying the fungi with what's called root exudates, and the fungi are bringing back things like phosphorus and different types of microbes and stuff. Same thing happens in our soils. So you can do things. And again, this is not something that I think you're going to put on the product and see this huge, like a nitrogen yield response. So I like to be very clear. This is a biological stimulation for the long-term health of your soil, but it's something that I've been really impressed where I've used it. And then I've gone into an old logging deck that was so compacted and I stuck a shovel in and the roots and you can literally see like mycelium hairs connecting with the roots, like where it's like little white hairs where all the roots are connecting and stuff. You know, that's about as good as you're going to see with the naked eye until you get under a microscope, which I have not got to that point yet. But all of that to say, those are our core product. The last one that we did add, which will give you a little bit more of that response most food plotters are probably looking for, but also has a good strong backing in stimulating biology, is our fish fertilizer plus humix, right? So we added that humix to make the nutrients even more stable, further drive your microbial stimulation, and then of course fish fertilizer is awesome from an NPK perspective, but also it has micronutrients in them. And fish fertilizer has a lot of amino acids and things. So that's very important from the protein synthesis, which happens within plants, which is pretty cool because if they can create plant proteins, right, and it's less stressful to do so, then they're less susceptible to things like drought and all these other things. And we could talk about how mycorrhizal fungi can play a role in there too. There's a lot of interesting research. But in general, high level, we had four or five products there, and hopefully I touched on those and didn't put anybody to sleep.
So for the average guy, right, when we know that like Jared does habitat plans and stuff like that, and they look at the timber and stuff like that, for you, it seems like you would be the guy to say, hey, will you look at my soil sample? Like, do you guys offer that sort of support, or do you offer that as a service? Because I know when a regular guy, like, you have to get a soil sample. Well, you send it off and then it just has a bunch of numbers on it, looking at ours from last year. And it's like, well, what does any of this mean? Right. And yeah. So where do you go for that?
You know, Adam, so actually that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this, right? I wanted to be a little bit different where we could be kind of a one-stop shop, right? Because again, you know, guy goes, oh, I wanted to, I got a soil test, but now I don't know where to go. Or I went there, so yes, I offer that service. People email me their tests quite often. Again, you know, it gets a little bit hard. There have been times where I'm like, I just can't, you know, this is like, there's nothing here. Like, I don't know this lab that did this, like, but there's no data here, you know, or here's what I would do, but I can't say anything else. But if you go through Ward, I actually get the results of every single test that people buy through us. So I get a copy. Not everybody wants, you know, an analysis, but if they do, we don't charge for that. I mean, the only thing I ask is that if an email back will suffice, it's a little bit easier to kind of break it down and go through an email than try to have it, because every discussion would be like an hour, you know, whereas like I can bullet point it. All right, pH on the pond stand plot is a little low. Here's the type of lime I would use. Here's why. And then if they have questions after that, then it's like a 10-minute call. Like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So that's typically how we do it. And we've been doing that for the last, you know, over 2 years, and it's been great. And I love, probably one of my favorite things. I probably this year have looked at, I don't know how many soil tests. I don't even want to make a guess on it. I got piled up on my desk here, but I really, really enjoy that. Whether it's the food plot guy or the garden person or the farmer, that's really cool.
So let's get a quick, before we round this out, like a success story, of yours personally, from like your food plotting journey. Like, cause you started out doing this and, you know, it's one of those things where everybody wants to, I guess what made it click for you, like that this can work or this is working.
Well, I think there's to try to give you one story is tough. I mean, obviously first thing I go to is a 5.5-year-old. I shot over a food plot the year before I started the company, right? It was their carbon load mix that I had been putting together for years, and shot him November 3rd out of the same stand. I passed him on 2 years to the day. I should pass him as a 3.5-year-old and killed him as a 5.5-year-old. So that was pretty cool. You know, that was really cool. He came into a field that I had pictures of him all summer long in my Nitro Boost. Again, we hadn't started the company yet, but I mean, in my Nitro Boost plot. That was actually funny too, because that was one of those years where I was so busy on that particular field. My carbon load from the year before had been tall, and I literally just went in there and broadcast the Nitro Boost on the back of the tractor and drove off. I was going to go back and mow it off and stuff. I ran out of time, or maybe it started raining that afternoon. I forget, but I just didn't have. And it ended up being like super messy, but I had that buck in there. He was in there all the time. And I had a north wind on November 3rd that year. And I was like, I don't know. He hadn't been in there a few days, but I'm going in there. And sure enough, hot doe came in. She bedded down. I watched him at 80 yards for like 45 minutes. He came in at 26 yards, turned around, went all the way back like 100 yards. I'm like, that was going to be the one that got away. And about another 30 minutes later, here she came back and came right by me. And he stopped and I killed him at 18 yards, and it was just awesome. So that would be a really good personal success story. Seeing the deer numbers increase has been really awesome too. You know, when we first bought the farm, we I wouldn't say struggle to see deer, but we didn't see the numbers that we thought we would see. You know, Ohio's a bait state and things like that. And I mean, I have fields that I know people are baiting not that far from me. And last year, my buddy was hunting the farm with me, saw 34 deer come into that field, you know, and it's still withstanding the browse pressure. And, you know, we it's cool to go and manage a farm where you're like, yeah, we need to shoot some does, you know. And we went from one extreme where we were like not shooting any, and all the neighbors are kind of like, oh man, I hope nobody's shooting too many, like trying to figure out like where all the deer went, to now being like, yeah, we're pulling deer in and we're seeing huge numbers of deer, and like we're gonna harvest a few and feel great about it, you know. So those would be some personal success stories of mine. And I think it's also coupled with, I work pretty hard with a chainsaw in my hand, do a lot of TSI, and getting a lot of neighbors on, but you know, doing all of the other things as well. I don't think you can just rely on any one thing when it comes to a wild animal and management.
Yeah. And multiple years, I think, is something everybody strives for, right? But that's got to be real cool to know it was the same deer. And I think there's also people out there who will 100% have the must be nice attitude, right? That, oh, this guy's passing deer and yada yada yada. So I mean, but it's great to be able to do that. And I think, you know, one of the things that we noticed last year in particular is, you know, I talked to Jared about our one field that's really close to our camp, and we planted that, and the deer numbers. Now, we weren't seeing, you know, 30 deer or whatever, but, you know, I was sending them pictures of 10, 11. I think the most we had was 16 in the field at one time.
Wow, that's awesome.
And, you know, we did just the no-till, and it was
I'm Will Cooper, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. If you haven't already, download the free Waypoint TV app to listen to our podcast and watch the original films from Hunt Stand Presents anywhere, anytime, and on any device.
A life that has the stories to back it. A life to be proud of. It's a Winchester life.
Yeah, baby. 6'8 Western. Oh, mule deer, baby, right there.
Tune in every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
Old fallow field, I guess is what you'd say. We didn't do any segregation, so I have no idea. And it was a rather ugly plot for sure. But the deer didn't care. And kind of like to your point there with that buck, you know, you said, well, it didn't come up as good, you know? So I think it's just like what we're doing. I'm staring at these bows here, but like, you know, there's a Ferrari and a Ford, and one looks really nice, but do they both have the same, you know, do they both get you to point A and B, to the end point? That's how you get there. What the fit and finish is one thing. And that was one thing that we noticed, is that the deer didn't care. You know, we did, we tilled in some of the spring plot in a really, really small area, and it came up 3-4 feet tall, and we then mowed around it and did no-till around it, and it was ugly. Like, it didn't come up. We didn't do any sort of segregation or anything like that, but the deer were in there every single day, you know, half a dozen at a time. And this is, you know, a half a mile from the other plot, and mm-hmm. that we're pulling different deer off of a different land. I mean, yeah, deer are transient, but they're not, the deer weren't in both places at one time. So they were different, you know, different deer.
Oh yeah.
And that was cool to see, and it was the same thing. And like, so what, as we're talking about this, I'm thinking, okay, so like, what do we got to do for this year, you know, as we're coming up on those dates, and it's up in the UP, it is 8 hours away, so it's going to be a very I don't want to say strategic, but like planned out, like, this is what we're going to do on these days, these are the things that we need to get done. So to try to figure that out. But I think we do need to put some of that segregation on there just to see how much, you know, the deer that are using it every day, day in and day out, what kind of damage they're doing to the crops that we're planting, right?
Oh, absolutely. And Adam, the thing is we are all always learning. And that's like the biggest thing I try to tell people is like, I have a field, we sold off some red pines, put in 3 acres of this. It's just going to be successional for hopefully oak regen, right? That's the goal. It's a clear cut. It's really awesome. The front three is a big food plot. I mean, it's on a flat. It's awesome. The dozer tracks were still warm, and I was in there on a tractor trying to get a play because it was getting late. I forget when it was, but it was like, I think maybe even into September, right? Now, I pulled soil tests on that field, and the soil was pH is below 5. So for like anybody, like most people just look at pH. And again, we get a whole other discussion on why you have to look at other things. But like just in general, people recognize like pH, and there's a tie there or correlation there to nutrient availability within soil. So anybody would say like below 5. Oh, my goodness. I was able to no-till drill. So that was the benefit, right? If I did not put an exclusion fence up, now, I had a lot of deer pictures in there and observation, but like just like if I didn't have a camera, I would have been like, well, that's because the fertility of the soil stinks because it's so low on pH, right? It had nothing to do with soil fertility. Inside that fence, I had 10, 12 inches of growth. Outside that fence was nipped to the ground. Now, the deer is in there eating all the time. I mean, you can see the green rows for the deer, but it's like, that's why, I mean, I even talk about exclusion fence, but even for me to see that, that was such a profound experience because I was like, man, if I would not have done that, I think I would have said, oh man, it's probably the soil, right? And the point is like, you can grow stuff in pretty crappy soil. Just get something growing, you know, don't wait. Just get started, get something going. It's like people always say, when's the best time to soil test? It's like the same time, you know, when's the best time to plant a tree? 10 years ago, like get going on it and then we'll figure out from there. And like you said, if you just get something started, then you can tweak. Oh, should we increase seeding rates? Should we do this? Should we do that? And that's been some of our best success stories. I've been working with guys who had struggled for years and some on huge scale, you know, planting 40, 50, 80 acres for deer all the way down to the guy doing a half acre and they had struggled and we've kind of dissected their issues and tweaked their systems a little bit and getting the phone call where they're like, man, I've never had deer numbers or I've never had the brassica production alongside clovers and rye and all these stuff. Like this is the, you know, I'm all in, this is great. And being able to tweak that, but in order to tweak it to specific to your farm, whether you're using ours or somebody, you have to get started. You got to get started on that process.
So we can wrap this up here pretty quick, but one thing that you, I guess you kind of alluded to right there that we didn't talk about at all, was, and one thing I know that we're not doing, and I know that even in the public land hunting and the guys that are serious about big deer in that avenue, you know, they're all keeping a journal, they're all keeping notes. And that's one thing that you didn't mention, but it seems like to tweak things and to make changes would be to keep a history or like kind of like a running tally of the things that you've done, things that worked, things that didn't. Where does that fall into like your system, or not necessarily for Vitalized Seed, but just like personally, or what you would recommend to guys as far as like keeping track?
Well, I mean, I would think the people by the here are like, this guy is a little bit analytical. So for me, I'm a little bit obsessed with it. So what I like to look at it from multifaceted perspective. So for soil, yes, I have a folder in my desk here. Now I did a video not that long ago. I call it like quick tips where I just do like a bullet list for that year. High point, added line, 2023. I want to add vitalized microbes, whatever, right? So then if I'm in the field or in the tractor, I can look and go, oh, okay, you know, just quick reference. So I remember, oh, I need to grab lime or whatnot. But overall, from a management perspective, I like to one, I like cell cameras, right? So I tell guys all the time, like, if you don't have solar panels on all of them, take a week during the year, like early October, where deer are pretty much going to move right at dusk, right? And if you have cameras set up on all your food plots, turn them all on instantaneous mode and watch to your point where you're like, I know they're like not the same deer. Do that and then look at the timestamps. So I've done that before. Now, Ohio is a bait state, so I can go in and pour corn in front of all those cameras as well, just to really trigger, because it'll trigger one deer at the corn pile, 20 or 10 in the background. So that's number one, is camera surveys. Number two, I'm a big, big proponent of browse surveys. So I really always want to look like, is multiflora rows as thick as my pinky getting browsed on in March? Like, it's a sign of a lot of deer, you know? So, then I'm going to do observational hunting surveys. And then on top of that, I'm going to do the, exclusion fence, you know, measuring of, okay, how much has been removed. And then from there, I really can say, okay, you know, what does that look like? Right. When I had the camera surveys, okay, I'll give you a quick example. 1 year I did it, just on cameras, right? So this is we're in big timber country. So this isn't counting oak flats or anything. And there were 17 does and one buck on those cameras in one evening in October, you know, on the farm. It's like, okay, let's say it's 300 acres, square mile, six, like, okay, start doing the math on that. You're going, that's a lot of deer per square mile, you know, that are being in, or that are in the area that are eating, you know, your forage or trees or whatnot. And I'm not saying to kill them all, but certainly I think we need to keep some in check. And then of course, hunting observations, like, hey, how many did you see? And just going through that and then being able to understand, okay, oh, I think we should come up with a quota to harvest a deer or not to. And then one other thing that I try to do is try to save a lot of pictures, like in a habitat album on my phone. So I remember, like, 2024 March, this is what the browse look like or whatnot, and get a better understanding as to kind of what's happening on the landscape of that particular property. But I think it's hard. It's a difficult thing. And I think you have to look at it from a wide lens and a lot of different areas, because if you just look at it, oh, I saw 30 deer in a cut cornfield in December. Well, yeah, you would hope that you would, you know, versus, you know, what was it like all year round or whatnot, and then make your decision based on that.
Yeah, I mean, I can totally see that. And again, like you said, everybody's learning. So trying to piece the things together, we all can just say, yeah, I think I did this last year. I think it was a good year last year or whatever. But to be able to go through, because I'm somewhat analytical too, where if I can have the numbers on something like this, you know, and again, when you're talking, you know, time, money, you know, all of these things that we're, I hate to say sacrificing for this quote unquote hobby or lifestyle that we have, you know, passion, I think is the best word for it. But, you know, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of resources. So if we can quantify one thing that moves the needle more than the other, I think that's something that we should definitely be tracking. But I know that currently in our setup, we're not. So it was interesting to.
I think if I could add one other piece to that, Adam, that I would say has probably made it the best impact. It's up there. I would say maybe the best impact on our management decisions is also, unless you have a reason to think that your neighbor's a jerk, the neighbors aren't always the problem. Like, try to meet your neighbor and try to have a discussion, because not only will you learn a lot and hopefully become friendly, you know, with them, but I think it'll give you a better understanding. It's like, man, I was seeing 30 deer in a field and I didn't realize that Joe has a big food plot too. And he was seeing deer every day. You're like, you know what I mean? You start, oh, and he's a great guy. He also wants to grow big deer. And I think that in my experience, some of the best things that I've done is got to meet neighbors. And now I can start adding up neighbors. Okay, now we got 2,000, 2,500, 3,000 acres of guys. And there might be a few guys in between, you know, but in general, like, of contiguous acres, and we're all on the same page, you know? And that makes, it just gives you a comfort of, like, knowing, and you know, hey, this guy, he's never going to shoot doves. Doesn't care. Doesn't, you know, he just wants, okay, that's fine. He's a great guy. But now I know that I'm probably going to up my quota just a smidgen because he's never going to do it. Or vice versa. This guy hammers, you know, so we don't need to, right? And I think that goes a long way in understanding. And in my experience, there's a lot of people tell you, oh, the neighbors are always the issue, and they'll kind of allude to that. But when you go out there and meet them and shake their hand and introduce yourself, it's been really, really good experiences for me and my friends who've helped me out.
Yeah. I think that's pretty good thing to do in any situation, right? Not, maybe not even just in hunting, but
that's but, true.
But yeah. Is there anything else you think we missed or anything that you think is important for?
I mean, I think there's, first off, just thank you for having me. I mean, I love talking about this stuff. I'm, you know, I hope that my passion comes through, because I am, I really do love it. And I mean, I love an opportunity to earn people's business and talk with them and share information. And even if you just follow us along and just to see like, hey, is this for me? You know, we do really appreciate it. And the biggest thing I would say to people is just get started. You know, when you're looking at stuff, taking a few different other people's, you know, options, you know, look at it, where information's either coming from or where you're gathering it from, and try to find what fits your situation, or give us a call and we'll be happy to work out and figure out something that's going to work for you. But all in all, just get started and enjoy it, because it's, you know, it's so fun to watch things grow. And if you can just get something going and watch a deer come in, it's just an amazing experience.
And what's the best way to get a hold of you for any questions or anything like that?
Well, the best way, you know, Vitalize Seed on Facebook, on Instagram, and then also, of course, we have a Vitalize Seed website, you know, vitalizeseed.com. The contact us page has my email on there, as well as my phone number that you can call or text with questions.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate the time and all the information. Like I said, this is the Bill Nye the food plot guy segment of the show.
Well, thank you so much, Adam. It's really been my pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks.
You're listening to the Waypoint Podcast Network, brought to you in part by HuntStand, the number one hunting and land management app.
Through the Blackwater bayous and in the dark Louisiana night floats a duck camp, alive with the sounds of swamp pop and the smells of Cajun cooking. From the Mississippi Delta in Venice to the Cajun prairies of the Southwest, me and the Duck Camp Dinner's crew will be hunting and eating it all.
This is Duck Camp Dinner.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.